It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as the COVID-19 pandemic picked up steam, many communities throughout the country and here in Wisconsin saw mutual aid groups stepping up to help people who are struggling. Learn more about those organizations and the role they've been playing during the pandemic. First, while the pandemic continues with record numbers of daily deaths in the U.S. in recent weeks, public health experts are working to learn lessons about the next global outbreak, whatever comes after COVID-19, though that may be hard to imagine. Public health experts warn about the cycle we often see with infectious disease. Authorities ramp up their response when the threat of an outbreak emerges, but then they neglect planning and preparing once the threat has gone away. Experts say that if the world is going to prevent another global pandemic like the one we're in now, a lot needs to change. In the U.S., misinformation and public distrust in science and government has led to a country with just 4% of the world's population making up about a quarter of global coronavirus cases. So what would need to change to keep the next outbreak from becoming as serious as the COVID-19 pandemic? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think are the biggest lessons for the COVID-19 pandemic? Looking back over the last year, what do you think government leaders, public health officials could have done differently? If there's another pandemic in our lifetime, how should the response be different? If you work in healthcare, what do you wish would have gone differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Ajay Sethi is an associate professor of population health sciences and director of the Master of Public Health program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's an infectious disease epidemiologist. Ajay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for inviting me to your show.
Well, before the pandemic started, are there ways in which you think we could have been better prepared for whatever the next pandemic turned out to be? It turned out it was COVID-19, but were there preparations that maybe we should have had in place even before we'd heard of this new coronavirus?
Yeah, definitely. The virus obviously emerged in Wuhan, China, and they made public quite quickly after the first case was reported, on December 31st. 2000 seems like a recently, but it was a while ago. The scientific community reacted pretty fast. As soon as the sequence of the virus was made public, the effort to develop a vaccine occurred quickly. Some governments were not as quick to respond, and that was definitely a big problem.
A concern I've seen from public health experts here in the United States in particular was, earlier plans before COVID-19 had said, hey, in the event of a nationwide pandemic, we need a nationally coordinated response. And that's something, things ended up being left more to state and local officials. We're seeing that again, it looks like, with the vaccine. Is that a concern you have?
Yes. The federal government, throughout, 2020 and now in 2021, just hasn't taken the leadership that they should. The kind of leadership you're seeing in other countries, rather than leaving things up to local jurisdictions. It is a partnership between the federal government and the state. But as we saw in 2020, institutions like the CDC were compromised by the White House and others. And so that was very problematic.
The Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, this is an independent group, they warned back in 2019, seems like forever ago, that more could be done to prepare for a pandemic. And here's a quote, "We ramp up efforts when there is a serious threat, then forget about them when a threat subsides." So how do we, when we're hopefully through with COVID-19 as a major threat, Ajay, how do we make sure we don't think, okay, we don't have to worry about pandemics anymore?
Well, this is a pandemic that is of a much, higher scale than some of the recent threats we've faced. So I would hope that our memory lasts more than a year. And if during that time with a new administration, if we can now begin to sort of bolster pandemic preparedness, maybe we won't be as reactive and more proactive as you suggest.
One concern I know you have, you teach a class on health-related conspiracies. That's been a big part of the story with the pandemic over the last year. How do we deal with our, intellectual infrastructure to try to beat back those conspiracies that I think got in the way of our COVID-19 response?
I wish I knew the answer to this one, and it's definitely has to be multi-pronged. So you had it right. I teach a class, Conspiracies in Public Health, been doing for almost 5 years now. The approach I take is because the students are clinicians, future clinicians and future public health practitioners, I take the approach that we need to have these conversations sort of one at a time, using almost like a counseling approach to talk to individuals whose views are just different from our own, maybe people who are generally misinformed. But there also needs to be, you know, at the scale of, you know, at the community level through companies like Twitter and Facebook, people who have social media platforms, you know, at much larger sort of levels, we also need to address misinformation spreading there. And it's a very daunting task. Misinformation existed before COVID, and COVID just showed, you know, how vulnerable we are to the spread of misinformation.
We're talking to Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison and Infectious Disease Epidemiologist. We're looking at lessons that we might be able to learn from COVID-19 and apply them to future potential outbreaks and the way we respond to them. Ajay, COVID apparently came from an animal population, as have so many other diseases that became public health threats or bordered on becoming health threats. We know these zoonotic diseases, I think they're called. There's a lot of them lurking out there. What do we need to do to have an early warning system to be ready for that potential pool of future human diseases?
Yeah, we are woefully underfunding surveillance. You know, in these sort of hotspots in the world where we have a lot of overlap in human populations, animal populations, where we know that sort of the next big one, so to speak, might come from. There are hotspots in the continent of Africa, thinking about Ebola, for example. And of course, in that Wuhan area of China, this is where our novel coronavirus came from. But also, mass farming of poultry and other kind of livestock. That's where we often see new emerging strains of influenza. And we're just not funding the surveillance for new strains nearly as much as we should be.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jerry on the line in Waukesha. Jerry, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Jerry?
Well, we can talk about a lot of things. Your guest is talking about funding, more money we got to send overseas like we already did with the $900 billion package they just signed in the government. That's not the issue. The issue is, number one, we didn't know what happened. Number two, we got screwed by China, and China screwed the world, not just the United States. Number three, we have to have checkpoints. We have to have international travel that goes through New York and Los Angeles and maybe Seattle exclusively. And we need to check people coming in. They never washed a New York City subway until somebody died in it. So now they wash all the cars every night.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. You gave us a lot of food for thought there. First of all, the role of China. I mean, Ajay, as you mentioned, on the upside, China shared the genome, the genetic code of the COVID-19 causing virus pretty quickly. But they were criticized for downplaying the disease, not wanting to cause panic, not wanting to hurt their economy. It's a story we saw in other countries around the world, including to an extent in the U.S. How do you evaluate the role of China in the early days of the outbreak?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously, there's tension between governments, China and other governments, including our own. And we have tension with governments that are not China. So that part sort of gets a lot of attention in the public because it's covered extensively. But I just want to emphasize that the scientific community, there was great cooperation, sharing of information, sharing of data, and very quickly behind the scenes, which didn't get a lot of press, were people working on a vaccine, which is what we have now. From what I understand, 2 days after the sequence of the virus was shared by scientists in China, a vaccine candidate was developed and testing, the preparations for testing began. So the idea that we have a vaccine within a year of a brand new agent is really unprecedented, and we can thank the cooperation between scientists for that.
Thanks for that call, Jerry, at 800-642-1234. And that leads me to another point. I've heard people point some of the success, that quick success on vaccine research, to some basic science that had been done before, working on, you know, vaccines for hypothetical diseases or for diseases that turned out not to be as menacing. Because we had that kind of basic stuff in place, it gave us the tools to quickly come up with a virus. Are there lessons there for the future?
Well, for this mRNA vaccine, the science was definitely decades in the making, and it's no harm in maybe putting in a plug for our university again. In the early 90s, there was some studies done in rats or mice showing that you can inject mice with a little piece of messenger RNA and begin to produce protein. So that science was sort of in the making for a while, and it's a reason why we can have a vaccine using a brand new platform. That's actually very exciting, frankly.
We're talking to Ajay Sethi right now, epidemiologist and associate professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison. We're looking at lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic as we still try to get it under control, but also lessons to be prepared for future potential outbreaks. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. What lessons do you think we should be learning from the COVID-19 pandemic for the future? Do you think it's possible to restore public trust in science, the media, the government? What kind of outreach would you like to see happen when it comes to public health issues like this? Are you old enough to remember when polio was a threat and that vaccination campaign? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk now with epidemiologist Ajay Sethi from UW-Madison, looking at how to prevent the next outbreak from becoming a pandemic as devastating as the one we're in now. You can join in still at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. What lessons do you think we should be learning from COVID-19 to help prevent outbreaks in the future, or at least limit their impact? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Platteville. Jim, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering what your guest thinks about the law that was passed in Florida recently requiring the reporting of the cycle count of PCR tests being reported to physicians and patients along with the results. I asked a big lab for this area what cycle count they were running, and they said they were running 45, and they were unaware that Dr. Fauci has said that over 35, those tests are meaningless. In fact, the research indicates that at 35 cycles, there are more than 97% false positives.
Thanks for the call. I'm not familiar with what Jim's talking about, Ajay. Are you?
Yeah, a little bit. The PCR test that's used to detect the virus in a sample, needs to amplify the genetic material that it's attempting to, detect. And you run cycles of this test, the PCR test. And the more cycles you run, you could say eventually everything will sort of become positive in a sense, but there'll be false positives, as Jim alluded to. When I've talked to folks at the State Lab of Hygiene, I believe they're also using 25 as a threshold for the PCR test. And there is debate in the laboratory community of whether or not to report the CT value, the cycle threshold value, with the results. And when I talk to folks at the State Lab of Hygiene, their general thought is that it's interesting, and it definitely is something that could be a value, but it's not some panacea for optimizing the test. That at the end, it's not necessarily prudent that you do so. But those things are still being debated.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Randy joins us next, calling from Madison. Randy, hello.
Hey, good afternoon. I just felt that the huge tragedy of this pandemic was that the president was not was so ego-driven that he could not step aside and let the experts, the Dr. Fauci's, take over, because there's this, you know, there's this terrific infrastructure that it could have gotten into place. Instead, he Trump kept charge. This turned out to be just as inept and incompetent as his other projects. And but in this case, that meant people died.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. Ajay, do you have thoughts on leadership, how political leadership can harness the power of the expertise around them in the best possible way?
I mean, leadership definitely matters. And it's unfortunate that this virus emerged during an election year. I can imagine everybody up for re-election this year had their New Year resolutions a year ago, thinking about their strategy to get re-elected. And, you know, this pandemic got in the way, and some of our leaders were able to pivot and others not. And of course, at the White House, it was it's a very different attitude. But we can look to our 50 governors. You see a wide range in responses. And when the leader at the top is not able to sort of embrace the challenge, there's an opportunity for other leaders to do so. And as citizens, I think we need to recognize that there are other people to look up to, and that's where we need to direct our focus.
Thanks for that call, Randy. And that reminds me of a kind of a related note, Ajay. In the early days of a disease, at COVID-19, no exception, we, including the scientific community, are still trying to figure out, and it's almost a sure thing that what we think we know at one point might change. What's the best way for the scientific community, public health leadership, political leaders to communicate that there's going to be some uncertainty and some things we think we know in March might change by April or May?
Yeah, I think that is a key thing. You have to say that there is uncertainty, and that anytime you make a recommendation, I think you have to end that with, and this might change, and maybe even offer a few scenarios under what circumstances could a recommendation change. And also maybe talk about the context in which a recommendation is being made. So in the early phase of this pandemic, we steered people away from wearing masks in public because we did not want those masks to not be available for healthcare providers. And then unfortunately that caused the messaging to really become distorted, and didn't help. Eventually, the messaging got better. So we, the scientific community, leaders, public health community learned. But you got to get it right the first time.
Talking to Ajay Sethi from UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at lessons from COVID-19, what we can learn from them, well, still for COVID-19 and for future potential outbreaks. Back to your calls now. Ethan is with us in Janesville. Ethan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that I think employers, especially large employers such as factories, should probably be a little more lenient with sick days, and maybe even just not paid sick days would be great, but just not being punished for taking time off or being sick. A lot of people are basically incentivized to come to the workplace sick to keep their benefits.
Ethan, thanks a lot for the call. Ajay, what do you think? Flexibility from employers is a possible disease spread checking mechanism.
No, yeah, definitely. Ethan brings up a fantastic point that, when we originated the idea of sick leave, it was actually to prevent respiratory infections from being spread in the workplace. And in recent years, moving away from paid sick leave to paid time off, which incentivizes people to save their time off for an actual vacation rather than staying at home while sick, has done damage. And we've seen outbreaks occur as a result of this. And I'm thinking about the outbreak in, I believe, New England and Boston, the Chipotle outbreak years ago, a norovirus outbreak. One of the employees came to work sick and unfortunately caused a chain of transmission. And that could have been avoided if somebody had the incentive to stay at home when they're sick.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last couple of minutes, Ajay, I mean, we started the conversation off looking at future pandemics. We're not through this current pandemic yet. Death numbers very high nationwide still. What are you hoping to see over the next few weeks or couple of months to try to bring that back down?
Well, I'm hoping the public can continue with mitigation. Everybody knows what the sort of the basics are for preventing transmission: the distance, the mask, staying at home as much as you can, and of course, washing your hands. And I think if we can continue that as sort of the kinks in vaccine distribution are being worked out, we should recognize that by adding vaccines to mitigation, we can really accelerate bringing these cases down. If we rely on the vaccine only, it's going to take a very long time. And if we rely on mitigation only, it'll also take a while. So having all of these tools is great, and we just need to not let up with mitigation.
In our last couple of minutes, what have you learned over the last 10 months or so of the pandemic that that you think could be applied for future diseases?
Well, I'll say that thinking about how this pandemic has affected all segments of society, has exacerbated sort of disparities that we have in our communities, I think this is an opportunity to learn that we can do better the next time, and just understanding the ripple effects of a pandemic like this. If the next pandemic is also spread person to person through the air, that means we're all vulnerable, and we need to do better next time.
Ajay, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate the invitation.
Ajay Sethi is an epidemiologist and associate professor of population health sciences at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked with us today about what researchers and public health officials are learning from the COVID-19 pandemic and how that can help us prepare for different outbreaks in the future. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about the role of mutual aid groups during the COVID-19 pandemic. These are things that have been started up at the neighborhood level or city or even county level, where people get together to check in on one another, help out in times of need. We'll talk about it. You can tell us if you've been doing something along these lines, and we'll meet a couple of Wisconsin organizers of these projects in a couple of different communities. I'm Rob Ferret. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, climate change expert Michael Mann joins the show for a look at his latest book, The New Climate War. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, since the beginning of the pandemic, many communities have come together to support people in tough times. Many have done that by creating mutual aid groups. These are community-based groups that directly provide resources, could include money or food, and other kinds of support to people in need. Mutual aid groups have been around for years, but gained a lot of traction in 2020 as the COVID-19 pandemic reached the U.S. These groups differ in a lot of ways from charity organizations and how they're organized and how they're run. Our next guest joins us to talk about the history and effectiveness of these groups in times of crisis. We'll also talk to the founders of two Wisconsin-based groups. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about mutual aid? If you've been involved with one of these groups, what has your experience been like? And even if you haven't been doing it formally, have you and the people in your community, your neighborhood, done things to help check in on each other through all of this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Lori Marks is Executive Director of the UW-Milwaukee Center for Community-Based Learning, Leadership, and Research. Lori, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited that you're talking about this topic.
Well, Lori, I gave a very limited definition of what mutual aid groups are. Can you flesh that out for us? What are they? What do they do?
Sure. So mutual aid groups are generally grassroots groups that form sometimes in times of crisis, where people they engage in exchange sort of for mutual benefit, and people kind of lean into the particular skills or resources they have, And at the same time, they may receive aid from the organization from along the lines of something that they don't have. So it's really based in this idea that it's a reciprocal relationship. It's very grassroots in nature. And they can really be geographic based, oftentimes very local around a neighborhood, but they can also be identity based. So some marginalized communities over the years have created groups that carry out some of these things.
Now, this is the basic concept I could see happening, I guess, anytime, any place in human history. What's the origin of this modern concept of the mutual aid group?
Well, if you just think about sort of the history of the country, you can imagine early on there was not much infrastructure. And so communities really had to come together to meet their very, very basic needs, right? So I think of things like even barn raising or firefighting. The example that I like to imagine is the idea of illuminating streets, where at one time communities came together and on alternate days, like every seventh person would put a lantern near the road. And it was just a time where there wasn't infrastructure. So they've always been around, and different situations called for different types of groups. I will mention one thing to think about is we oftentimes think about survival in terms of survival of the fittest, right? But mutual aid groups really look at it. And if you think about it historically, it leans into this alternative perspective where survival can really be based in cooperation amongst community members.
Yeah, I've seen the suggestion that, okay, one way to prepare for a disaster is to, you know, have food and supplies for yourself. Another way might be to make sure you are able to help others. You know, the people in your neighborhood, you're able to lend each other support in different ways. That's kind of that second part there. That's the mutual aid philosophy, if I have that right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think about how early on in the COVID pandemic, there was sort of this, you know, run on things like toilet paper. And I'd like to think, I didn't have a stockpile of toilet paper at the time, but, I'm pretty confident that the people around me would have helped if I would have needed it.
Talk to Lori Marks from UW-Milwaukee Center for Community-Based Learning, Leadership, and Research. We're talking about mutual aid groups. They've gotten big in this last year during the pandemic year. They've been around a lot longer than that. You could join in if you have experience with this or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's meet someone now involved in one of these mutual aid groups. Paulo Delgado is founder of Dane County Neighbors Helping Neighbors. The group's Facebook page has about 13,000 members. Paulo, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what inspired you to help start Dane County Neighbors Helping Neighbors?
A lot of the issues that we've been dealing with in the past few days, the division and what have you, are I think that COVID exposed a lot of gaping weaknesses in our society, and I think a big part of the response and what I'm trying to do is making people feel closer to their communities. And a big part of that is giving people a platform to help people around them, which allows them to feel closer to their community.
On a practical level, Paulo, what kind of things have members of Neighbors Helping Neighbors been doing with and for one another?
All types of things. I've seen people give each other jump starts late at night. People will post that they need a jump and where they are. And, you know, usually people will respond. I think that's a big part of the reason Facebook is a good tool for something like this.
And what was the response when you started floating this idea? Did people embrace it pretty quickly?
I didn't actually float the idea. I just set the group up and it took off pretty much instantly. I think we had 6,500 members by the end, by day five.
And, you know, eventually the pandemic will wind down, hopefully sooner than later. Do you have hopes to keep this going even when we're, you know, not being hit by COVID-19?
I think it's up to the community. People will be able to decide if the infrastructure that we built will remain central to the community going forward, but it's up to people if they want to stay engaged, and I hope they do.
Paulo, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Lori, we just heard from one group here in Wisconsin, and that one kind of a unique thing that wasn't around for mutual aid groups in decades too long ago was the ability to connect with each other on social media. How has that affected mutual aid groups?
I think social media has been a really important tool, and it has brought, in some ways, mutual aid groups to the mainstream. They historically have been thought of as sort of this radical idea. But what social media has done is it's brought people into relationship with one another. And like the guest offered, you know, people, it's a platform where they're empowered and they can show solidarity. So you have all these people who are actually participating in these things, maybe without even realizing it. I think of things like the Buy Nothing groups that exist in neighborhoods on Facebook. In the community I live in, there's been an effort to collect food in our neighborhood for a Food is Free pantry in another neighborhood. And so I think social media has turned out to be a really powerful tool for these groups.
That was, we heard, by the way, from Paulo Delgado from Dane County Neighbors Helping Neighbors. Didn't say his name on the way out of that interview there. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Tim, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about, Tim?
Similar thing to what was going on in Dane County. There was a Facebook page started in Winona, called Neighbors Helping Neighbors, and same kind of thing. It just kind of springed forward a lot of bright things that were happening during such a dark time, especially the holidays. There was organizations and community members and restaurants and stuff providing free meals for people who didn't have, you know, places to go, families to see, that kind of thing. Where I work at a restaurant, we were able to provide, I believe it was like 125 meals for people at Christmas. So it was pretty awesome. And then there's been other organizations and Facebook groups that have sprung out of this. There was a Hungry and Hurting group that came forward, and now just people are donating money, and this lady's running it and delivers food from different restaurants to local people. And it's kind of a two-prong approach. It's helping people in need, but it's also helping these small businesses still make money because it's all donations. So it's a pretty awesome thing. And like I said, it's just a positive thing impacting during such a dark time right now.
Tim, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. And Lori, talk about that. We haven't focused maybe enough on the positive things like that, these spontaneous things popping up communities in, as Tim said, this dark time.
Absolutely. I think the silver lining, if there is one, is that people, A, will see some of the needs that exist in their community that they actually have the power to be a part of. So I think that's one piece that, we can hope happens. I think also just being in relationship with others. People will have relationships through mutual aid groups that they may not have had had the group not brought them together. And that also will be a positive outcome for those individuals, but also for the community at large.
Tim, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Lori Marks right now, Executive Director of the UW-Milwaukee Center for Community-Based Learning, Leadership, and Research. She's with us to talk about the rise in mutual aid groups during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have participated in one of these groups, what's your experience been like? What do you want people to know about these groups? Do you have questions about mutual aid? And have you done something, even if you're not calling it that, have you been involved in something in your neighborhood, your community, to help each other out, informally maybe? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation and meet another Wisconsin Mutual Aid Group organizer. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about COVID-19 and the rise of mutual aid groups in Wisconsin and around the country. Lori Marks stays with us, Executive Director of the UW-Milwaukee Center for Community-Based Learning, Leadership, and Research. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you've been involved in one of these mutual aid groups, formally or informally, ways for your neighborhood, your community to help one another out during a tough time. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's talk to the founder of another Wisconsin-based mutual aid group. Ahmad Rivera-Wagner is the founder of the Green Bay Mutual Aid Group. Ahmad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me.
Well, tell us about the origins of the Green Bay Mutual Aid Group.
Well, one of the things that we saw here early on in 2020, which feels like a century ago, was that my partner was a frontline healthcare worker. He's the son of dairy farmers. And one of the things he saw coming into the ER was a bunch of workers from the meatpacking plants in our community. And so we were having a conversation over dinner saying, well, what are we going to do? This at the time was something that was being contested on whether or not COVID was going to spread, if there was any issues at that time in 2020. We didn't see that many cases in Northeast Wisconsin, but we started hearing about all these families that were being impacted. And so, I'm Black and Puerto Rican, and my mother is immunocompromised. I said, well, someone should help create some space for people who may not be used to getting services or support to ensure that those families get the access they need to something as simple as food and access, because they might be losing their jobs. Two weeks later, we had a major outbreak at the meatpacking plants in Green Bay, and Green Bay was ground zero for what then became a larger hotspot for the rest of 2020, which is now just going down. And so we wanted to make sure that those families and any families that were being impacted really came together. One of the things that's really beautiful about Green Bay is that so many friends and neighbors are willing to work together to solve problems. I feel like that's a very natural element. And so I just felt like this is something I could put together, and that so many people started participating and helping and working together to really, one, find the resources that were needed for these families and other families as they started being impacted by COVID, but ultimately becoming a place to communicate and convene, at least online, while we were all kind of dealing with the pandemic.
And Ahmad, what kind of problems did you solve along the way? You had your initial vision for it. What kind of things have you encountered since then that you and the members of the mutual aid group have helped overcome?
Well, we kept it relatively simple. Once I started this group, I reached out to other mutual aid groups, not only in Wisconsin, but there started being national convening groups. And, so many folks were trying all kinds of really impressive things, from fundraising and checking accounts to coordinating rides. We try to get those things started. I felt some discomfort around asking people for information or handling money. We wanted folks to be able to not worry about any issues or credibility. And so what we really focused on is making sure people got access to the resources they need. So the first thing we tackled was, what were families doing that were impacted, that couldn't go to the grocery store, right? These were folks who had received a COVID positive diagnosis, and that they couldn't necessarily go to the grocery store, and they might have lost their jobs or been removed from the working for several weeks. And so we worked on making sure that they got access to food pantries, that there were folks who'd be willing to deliver food to individuals, that we would, there were some other projects that started popping up in the city that were putting together boxes and packages for families to be able to deliver them to people's homes on their doorstep. And we started trying to find people who both would be open to deliver, but also supporting people with different types of food, particularly culturally relevant foods for all the broad diversity, more diversity than most people think about Green Bay, but we have a huge AAPI population, a large, relatively large Black population, a huge Latino population here. And so we wanted to make sure that doing that was really, really important. And given that there are folks who often have mixed immigration statuses, we didn't want folks to feel encumbered by their status, not to be able to ask, get, or receive or support. And so that was one of the other elements that we wanted to make sure we were able to get things to, because at times even government resources required Social Security numbers or government or citizenship status. And we just want to make sure that families got what they deserved and needed during a really tough time.
And as we wrap up, Ahmad, are you hoping that the Green Bay Mutual Aid Group will have a role even in a post-COVID era?
You know, I think there's something incredible when communities come together to solve really complex and tough problems. And I think that's something, given what we've seen over the last year and as we are entering the new year, that too often divisive rhetoric has caused kinds of issues, not only in local communities, but national communities, that this mutual aid moment and space really was something that, regardless of you know, where you came from or what language you spoke or what side of the aisle you were on, that people deserve to get supported and help, was such a beautiful, beautiful thing that I was really proud to be a part of. And I would hope that in the post-pandemic world that we hope to see the end of soon, that we can really keep that kind of dynamic going and moving forward. So if there's a, you know, part two or stage two of the mutual aid group in Green Bay, that would be fantastic. My dream and hope is that we'd be able to do more things in person post-pandemic and really think about the needs this community has to offer. But I will say that I also am okay with it ending. There are some really incredible nonprofits and government agencies in the area who really, really stepped up during this pandemic. And this was kind of a temporary patch with the network of services during a very unclear and undetermined time. And, you know, I would also be happy and glad to see this community supporting and uplifting the community. The organizations are already doing such great work and helping them to amplify their impact. And so I was just happy to play a small part, a very tiny part, into what so many great people are doing, and just happy that people like my husband and other people who are experiencing on the firsthand had some party to turn to or reference folks to. And I think the network of organizations coming together now, there might not even be a need for the Green Bay Mutual Aid Group anymore. Right. And I think that
Ahmad, I want to bring Lori Marks back in. Thank you so much for joining us today. Ahmad Rivera there from the Green Bay Mutual Aid Group. Lori, your thoughts on what we just heard from Ahmad?
Well, it's a great example of how communities have come together to meet needs. And it also goes to show how when people do that outside of general, you know, in organizational structures or government structures, they can do it quickly and efficiently, and they can meet direct needs. So I think that's a really that came through in what he talked about. And then the last thing I'll just say, too, is that these groups are political in nature, because they oftentimes reveal where our safety net isn't working. And so I hope people will recognize that and stay involved in whatever ways that they are comfortable being involved in the process. Right now, people are turned off by politics, I think, and this is a great way to be involved in a way that you're kind of what I like to think of as like a doer versus a debater.
Lori, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lori Marks is Executive Director of the UW-Milwaukee Center for Community-Based Learning, Leadership, and Research. She joined us today to talk about the growth of mutual aid groups during the COVID-19 pandemic. We also heard from Paulo Delgado, founder of Dane County Neighbors Helping Neighbors, and Ahmad Rivera, founder of the Green Bay Mutual Aid Group. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out the latest on the response to last week's violence at the U.S. Capitol, including efforts to remove President Trump from office before Inauguration Day. And anger is part of being human, and we have the power to use it for good or bad reasons. A Wisconsin psychologist tells us the story of anger with his new book, Why We Get Angry. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. On last week's edition of Food Friday, we talked about casseroles, and we got into the distinction, if there is one, between hot dish and casserole. A lot of you called in at the time, and we've heard from you on the Ideas Network Facebook page, too, with some casserole favorites and the casserole versus hot dish controversy. Peter, first of all, says that having a tuna casserole fried with eggs the next morning is the best. Peter says, trust me. And yeah, most, it's like there are very few leftovers, Peter, I agree, that aren't better with a fried egg on top of them. So I'm all about that. But then the big controversies, Joe wrote, it's not a casserole, it's a hot dish. And that set off a lot of back and forth, all good-natured, I should say. Julie says the name depends on which part of the state you live in. Liz says, born and raised in Wisconsin, didn't hear of hot dish until Prairie Home Companion. Al says, it's hot dish. I am from Minnesota, though, so maybe it is a state thing. Al says, I was a Prairie Home Companion groupie before you had to pay for tickets. Joe comes back and says, I wish WPR would stop bringing up these contentious topics. Well, I'll say for myself, I didn't mention it on the show. I'm from Michigan. I heard casserole only. I did not hear of hot dish until I moved here to Wisconsin. But that's, you know, it's a regional thing. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.